The title of my talk this morning is What is Worldliness? And the reference that I'd like to take from the scriptures is in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 to 17. Now when I say what is worldliness, you may well indeed ask. I think if you spoke to people who are not familiar with the Christian jargon, they'd probably find the expression a bit strange. Because Christians do tend to talk about the evils of the world, or things being worldly, or people being worldly. Or they talk about worldliness as an evil to be avoided. But what in fact is it? Well, we're not talking about the world of nature, or the world of physical things you look at. We're speaking about it in the context that the Bible talks about the world. And the Bible says that the world has become corrupt through sin. Sin entered the world, we are told. At another place we are told that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. Jesus referred to Satan as the prince or the ruler of this world. Paul spoke also of the god of this world or the god of this age. Because there are in the world principles of operation which are contrary to those of the kingdom of God. And so there's conflict between these wrong things and the ideals which God would have for us. Now this is the area that I'm speaking about this morning, and this is what we would call, if you like, worldliness. Worldliness means the sin or the attitudes or the wrong things that have come into the world through the entrance of sin into the world. Now sometimes people tend to use the expression in a much more limited way. We're all familiar with people who branded certain things as worldly or certain entertainments or pleasures as worldly. Now that's a very, very limited sort of an understanding, and I certainly hope that we won't be bogged down on that this morning. I think that's a very inadequate understanding. We live next door to some exclusive brethren, and they have a very sensitive approach to certain forms of entertainment, and they consider lots and lots of things worldly. It was well illustrated when we heard two of their children playing just beside the fence. They had a little doll's house there, and inside the doll's house, miniature furniture. The boy and the girl were having a conflict, and the boy in the end came out with the supreme onslaught by saying, "Anyway, you're worldly because you've got a TV in your doll's house." Now, we may smile at that, but that attitude still lingers on. That people have got these little categories, and certain things are put in those categories and they're worldly, and other things which are not in those categories are not worldly. And I don't think that's the way we should be thinking about it. I think it's people that are worldly rather than things. It's attitudes. And so I want to look at some of these areas this morning. What I'd like to do is to look first of all at what I consider to be the two main features of worldliness. Then I'd like to summarize what we say there by giving two general guidelines concerning our own attitudes. And then I'd like to conclude with two extremes that are to be avoided. So if you look at 1 John chapter 2 verse 15... we'll find that he says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passes away and the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever." That really is the key passage. There are lots of other passages, but from this we can draw two main characteristics of the world, or of worldliness, or of worldly attitudes. These two main characteristics are covetousness, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes, wanting things, and pride, the pride of life. Covetousness and pride. I'd like to develop these two ideas for a few moments. Covetousness means that we're wanting something. It may be something you can see, it may be something you can't see. It may be a material thing, it may be wealth, it may be something you can't see, such as power or influence, but it's wanting something. Now, when we become engrossed in the thing that we're wanting, the tendency is for that thing to usurp the place of God. And then, once that has usurped the place of God, that is called idolatry. That is why it is that in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, we are warned against covetousness, which is idolatry. The thing we covet dominates us, and we become absorbed in that until that thing usurps the place which God should have. And this other thing of pride, where pride, you might say, is the very essence of self-sufficiency. We want to be the center of the world. We want to be the center of our lives, the center of all our ambitions, whatever it might be, centers on ourselves, instead of centering upon God. And because we like this self-sufficiency, the tendency then is, the temptation is, not to depend upon the Creator, not to depend upon God. That leads then to all sorts of other evils. Now, one of these is one that we don't often think about, and that is simply anxiety. Anxiety, you might say, about the future. That is a form of worldliness. We won't depend upon the Creator. Therefore, if we won't depend upon the Creator, we fear to trust the future to Him. We feel that we've got to work things out better. And so this leads us then to cease to trust Him. That is a form of worldliness. Jesus Himself said so in Matthew chapter 6, where He said, "Do not be anxious, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the Gentiles seek all these things." The Gentiles, meaning the heathen people, the worldly people, the people who don't have God. They're worried about those things because they don't trust God. Now, in that passage I just read, in the older versions, I think the King James Version, it said, "Take no thought of the future." Now, that's a bad translation. It's a mistranslation, really. Jesus was not saying, "Take no thought of the future." There are many places where He says you should take thought of the future. What He was saying is, don't be anxious about the future. There's a lot of difference. The Christian should take thought about the future, but he is not anxious about it because he trusts in God. But if, of course, we're taken over by pride, well, then we cease to trust in God, and we're trusting in our own organization, our own selves, the things that we can do, and then we become no different from the person who doesn't have God. Now, the person who doesn't have God doesn't trust God for the future, and so he becomes anxious. The Christian does trust God for the future, and so he says, don't be anxious. What shall we eat? What shall we drink? But what shall we wear? These are the things that the worldly man is anxious over, but he says you should have trust in your Heavenly Father that He cares for you. So anxiety then is a form of worldliness. But the more obvious one, in this matter of pride, because we want to be self-sufficient, we don't want to trust God, this leads to the other evil of then wanting to be as good as everybody else, preferably better than anybody else. And then this opens the way for a whole lot more evils to enter in. Covetousness and pride. The pride of life, wanting to be better than others, never being satisfied to take some sort of humble place or second place or menial place, but jealousy sneaking in, not being satisfied with what God has given us, seeing somebody else with something else, and so covetousness and pride join together. We want, that's covetousness, we desire to be better than the other man, and that is pride. Now, I think you can look at every aspect of our lives and the evils that trip us up, and you'll find that these two characteristics come through repeatedly. That's why it is that John said, don't love the world or the things in the world, because if you love these things, the love of the Father isn't in you. Because all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, these things are not of the Father, they are of the world. Now, these things are going to pass away, but he who does the will of God will abide forever. He will trust in God, as we read in Matthew chapter 6, where Jesus said, don't be like the Gentiles. Let's take just a few examples. The obvious one that you've all thought of, I guess, as I've been speaking, is the one of possessions. Material prosperity. And here again, we can never go to a dance, never go to the pictures, not even have a TV set, and still be thoroughly worldly if we have a wrong attitude simply to cash, or to our homes, or to our vehicles, or to anything that is material. Covetousness and pride can sneak in, and they can make a person thoroughly worldly, even though that person could live a life where he virtually cuts himself off from his fellow man and isolates himself. You see, he wants to keep up with his neighbour and preferably be better than him. It can sneak into our occupations. a person can be in a very legitimate occupation and yet have a wrong attitude towards it. Now, we might say bad occupations are things like SP bookies, or, you know, we can think of people like this and we say they are worldly occupations. But we can have a very good occupation, one that's noble and that helps our fellow men and all that, and yet we can still be thoroughly worldly in the way we carry it out if we have an attitude which is one of covetousness, of greed and of pride, whereby we are working for our own selfish interests rather than for the interests A, of God's kingdom, and B, of our fellow man. Once we've forgotten those things that put ourselves first in our occupations, we can become worldly. Now, there's nothing wrong with ambition. In fact, I think it is a natural development from a conscientious person. We should never be satisfied with what we're doing. We should always want to do better if we're Christians. There's nothing wrong with ambition, but there's a lot wrong with selfish ambition. And that's the thing we've got to be careful of, because selfish ambition is another form of worldliness. Listen to what James says. Where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there you will get disorder and every vile practice. So the Christian is different from the non-Christian in these very subtle ways. He thinks of the future, just like everybody should think of the future, but he's not anxious. And if you are anxious, you're worldly. He wants to improve himself. You might say he's ambitious. But if he's selfishly ambitious and resorts to vile practices and is jealous, well, then he has crossed the line from one who is spiritual and he's become one who is worldly. The same, you might say, applies to education. God doesn't desire people to be ignorant. He doesn't desire us to be dull, like an ox or an ass, he says. He wants us to have wisdom and to have knowledge. He wants us to grow and to learn. It's one of the heavy emphases in the letters of Paul, how we should grow in knowledge and in wisdom and in discernment. True wisdom can very easily pass over into worldly wisdom. Once the person loses the principles of the kingdom of God and instead applies the principles of this world. And once again, James has something to say about that. He says, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, don't be false to the truth, don't boast, because this is wisdom which is from the world. That's worldly wisdom. So worldly wisdom is thinking without reference to God, thinking in terms of selfish motives, jealousy and the like, and that wisdom, James says, is not from above. It is earthly, it is unspiritual, it is devilish, it is worldly. But the wisdom which is from above is first pure, then it's peaceable and it's gentle and it's open to reason, it's full of mercy and good fruits. It's without uncertainty or insincerity. And you see the very fine line. Wisdom is godly. Worldly wisdom is fleshly. The Christian has to walk a very slender line, you might say. There's no easy way. We can't simply sit back and chop off certain things and say, all of those things are worldly, I won't do them, and then I'll be a good spiritual Christian. It doesn't work that way. There is no area of our lives where we are free of these temptations. There is always the temptation to adopt an attitude which is not a Christian attitude. Whether it's our possessions, or our occupation, or our education, or whatever. And once we adopt that attitude which is not a Christian attitude, then no matter how much we have cut ourselves off from the pleasures of this world, we are still, according to the definition of the Bible, we are still in God's sight, worldly. And when you come to your leisure or your entertainment, which is the area where people normally like to brand people or things as being worldly, once again we find that God is encouraging us to be discerning, to sort out the evil from the good. He doesn't say the TV is worldly, but books are not worldly, or the newspaper is not worldly, or the radio is not worldly, but the cinema is worldly, because you know what happens then. People do not do one thing, and then it's open slather with the other thing. In every area of our lives, no matter what we see on the telly, no matter what we read in books, no matter what we talk about, no matter what parts of the newspaper we read or don't read, in every area of our lives, we've got to apply a very severe discipline upon ourselves, and we've got to discern what is good and what is worthless. There's something worthless in every area of our lives, and we've got to get rid of those things. We've got to sort out the good from the bad. This is what Paul said when he wrote to the Philippians. He says, look, my brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honourable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, gracious, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, then think about these things. We have to apply this discernment and see if in the particular area of our interests or our leisure or our hobbies or our occupation or our education or our families or our possessions, whatever it is, we have to look and weigh these things according to what we have here. And we've got to discern, is it honourable, is it true, is it worthwhile, or is it something that is worthless, that is ungracious, that is horrible, that is selfish, that is greedy? We have to apply these standards. So I might then summarise these two features of worldliness: covetousness and pride. You could summarise these things by saying something like this: things which in themselves are legitimate may become worldly when we devote an all-absorbing interest to them. I'll say that again. Ordinary things, good things, things that we all have, every one of us here, even these things can become worldly when we give an all-absorbing interest to them. And they swallow us up, and we have an attitude which is no different from the person who's not a Christian. I don't think there is any area whatever where the Christian should have a fundamentally same attitude as the non-Christian. Always the Christian will have different values to apply when he's assessing the worth of something, because he belongs to the kingdom of God and his mind is saturated with the scriptures. So that's the first of these guidelines, that these things become worldly once we get them out of perspective and devote ourselves to them more than we should. Now the second point I'd like to make is that it is in our attitude to legitimate pursuits that the Christian must be different. So the first one is about things, and the second one now is about our pursuits in life, such as I mentioned, our occupation or our families or our way of doing things. It's in our attitude to all these things that the Christian must be different. That brings me now to the third category I was going to speak about this morning, and that was the two extremes to be avoided. We've seen the two features of worldliness. I've summarised our attitude under these two guidelines, but now there are two extremes I think we've got to avoid. And the two extremes are well illustrated in the New Testament because of people called Gnostics. Gnostic is spelled G-N-O-S-T-I-C. It's from the Greek word gnosis, from which we get our English word knowledge. The people who were the Gnostics were the people who had the knowledge. They knew things. They infiltrated the church with these ideas, and they imposed their thinking upon Christian things and came up with some rather weird answers. Basically, what the Gnostic was saying was this: that everything that is material is evil. Now, there are some people in the Christian church who tend to have that same attitude. We'll come to this as we move along a little. But there are a lot of people that have a very wary attitude to anything that's material. In a way, you might say, fair enough, because we are very easily tripped up by material things. But matter is not evil in itself. You know, the world we live in, the trees and the rivers and the things that are made out of them and the buildings and the cars that all come out of the minerals that are in the earth or the vegetation that's in the earth, these things in themselves are not evil. But there were these Gnostics who said anything that's made of material in this world is evil. The whole world has been corrupted by sin, therefore anything you make out of it, even the chairs you're sitting on here, are made out of trees, and trees are material and they're part of an evil world, and so the whole thing is tainted by evil. Now that was one of the fundamental teachings of this Gnosticism, and Paul and John both had to counter it on a number of occasions. Now if you say that matter is evil, you're going to be led to one of two extremes, and these are two extremes I'm warning against. The first one is what I would say is the extreme followed by the legalist. He says, all these things in the world are evil, therefore I must withdraw from them as much as I can. And so he makes rules for himself. He becomes what you might call an ascetic. An ascetic is a person who denies himself certain things. He devotes much rigor to his own body so that he doesn't get involved in some of these evils, and he pursues a life of very, very strict self-discipline, like a very ancient monk living out in some place where he's cut off from the things of the world. That's what we call asceticism. Now the person who follows one line will say, because the earth is full of evil and material things are so evil, therefore we must do all we can to isolate ourselves from them. But asceticism does not equal holiness. Now I've got a good example in the person of John the Baptist as compared with Jesus Christ. John the Baptist was an ascetic. That is, John the Baptist did not eat certain foods. He did not drink certain drinks. This was because he was a Nazarite and he had taken upon himself certain vows, and he didn't have the freedom to eat and drink the things that the normal person ate and drank. Now Jesus came along, and Jesus was not bound by these limitations that John was bound by. And of course he was criticized for it. But the point I'm making is this: you can't say that John was holier than Jesus. Or to put it the other way around, you can't say that Jesus was more worldly than John. Asceticism does not equal holiness at all. Now, when I was younger, if we can go back, let's say, 30 years, when I was a teenager, we were very much forbidden to do lots of things. We were told about the evils of worldliness. The general tendency in our churches then was towards legalism. That is, you can't go here, you can't go there, because if you do, well, first of all, Mr. So-and-so would say something to you if you did, but you were not to go there because it was worldly or because of some other reason that somebody trotted out. You see, the people were saying the world is evil, you've got to cut yourself off from it, you've got to isolate yourself from it. We had all these laws. I can remember even listening to the radio and frightened that Mr. So-and-so would walk in the door and catch us listening to it, because, you know, these things were looked upon as worldly, as evil. And so people got a whole lot of laws, and they thought if you follow all these laws and don't go to these worldly places and do these worldly things, then you'll be a good Christian. Well, it simply doesn't work that way. This is what the Gnostics did. They said the world is evil, therefore you've got to avoid contact with it as much as you can. And so they got a whole lot of laws. And this is what Paul had to fight against when he wrote to the Colossians. He said to them, look, the fact that you're adhering to all these laws in itself is worldly. And Paul said the same to the Galatians. He said, you have been justified by the Spirit. Now, are you going to be made more perfect by adhering to all these laws? Remember the letters to the Galatians? And he said, look, for freedom Christ has freed us. Now stand firm, stand steadfast in the freedom that Christ has given us, and don't return to a yoke of bondage. He says, all these bondages, all these laws they've given you, he said, they lead to a terrible bondage, and Christ has freed us from that bondage. So don't make these laws. If the Bible doesn't say it, don't create a whole system for ourselves and tie ourselves up in knots. If we do, that is not the attitude of a spiritual man. He said, that is the attitude of a worldly man. That's the attitude of a person who doesn't have the Spirit. Now he says, you have the Spirit, and you've been freed from the law. Don't go back to the law. And so the very making of these laws is itself worldly. So when Paul wrote to the Colossians, because many in the Colossian church were trying to withdraw from society, cut themselves off, insulate themselves, isolate themselves, immunize themselves so that they weren't affected by all the worldly things round about them, we find that they were led into a great bondage to these laws. And this is what Paul says to them. He says, look, if with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the universe, you died to all these things, why do you live as if you still belong to the world? Why do you live as if you're still a worldly person, as if you're still part of this whole system? Why do you live like that when Christ has made you free and given you new life? Why do you live like a worldly man, he says? Why do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. Referring to things which all perish as they are used, that is referring to material things. He says these precepts and these doctrines and these commands that you're submitting to, these have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting rigor of devotion and self-abasement and severity to the body, but they are of no value in checking the indulgence of the flesh. They won't make you more holy in the long run. And that quote that I've just read is from Colossians chapter 2, verses 20 to 23. So withdrawing is not the answer. That's one extreme. We come up the 30 years since my youth, and we come to the present. And there's been a reaction against that old legalistic approach, where we're all told what we shouldn't do, and we all lived in dead fear that if we went somebody might see us going there, and then we'd be put on the carpet next Sunday. People have reacted against that, but now they've gone to the other extreme. And they're now being guilty of the extreme that the other branch of the Gnostics were guilty of. And that was this. Remember the first one? The world is evil. Therefore, if you want to escape evil, you've got to withdraw from the world as much as you can. Now, the alternative to that is this. If the world is evil, and the material things are evil, no matter how much you try to withdraw, you can never totally withdraw yourself, because you're still living in a material world. So, what the heck? You may as well do as you please, because you'll never escape from materialism, so enjoy the lot. So then you have the other extreme. You follow them through and you say there's a reasoning in both of them. And the Gnostics could do it, because what they said was this: we have a superior knowledge. We are the Gnostics, we are the knowing ones. We have come into a greater knowledge of God and His will, and we know the world is evil, we know that you can't escape it, therefore you may as well just live to please yourselves and get the most out of it. And if you commit evil, and if you get involved in these evil things of the world, it doesn't matter. Because in your mind, you know that you're above them. You know that you've spiritually entered the higher realm, therefore the deeds of the body don't really affect your soul. You are sort of a spiritual elite. You've seen through the old system, and you can do these things, because after all, the Bible doesn't say you can't do them. So you can do them, and you can still be a good Christian in doing them, because you've got the knowledge of God that says it's okay. You see, that's the other extreme. Now, that's the extreme, I think, that is pretty rampant today. Now, there are some churches that are still very legalistic, and there are some that have gone the other way. And there are Christians, of course, in both camps. But whereas Christians formerly tended to be very restricted, now you find that many of them have no restraints whatever. And they are guilty now of the opposite extreme. There doesn't seem to be any discipline. And there doesn't seem to be any difference whatever in the things they do or the places they go or their attitude to the things I mentioned, like leisure or pleasure or possessions or occupation or whatever. They rationalize it and justify themselves. Now, that particular evil was the evil which John was writing against in his first epistle. The former evil was the one Paul wrote against in Colossians. This opposite extreme is the one that John writes about in his first epistle, where people were saying, we can do the same things as the ordinary person in the world does, and it won't affect us. We can sin as we like, and it won't affect us, because we have come into a superior knowledge of what it's all about. John answers them by saying, you're wrong. He who is born of God does not commit sin. You think he can commit sin. You think he can do as he likes and just let the whole thing go. Well, he says that's wrong too. That's in 1 John chapter 3, verse 9. Now, those are the two extremes we've got to avoid. I don't believe that as Christians there is any pat answer. We simply cannot think that if we conform to one or two little things, we can just waltz along our way merrily and not bother. This whole area of worldliness and its evils is something that is a day-by-day battle for us. We've got to walk a steady line, avoiding the extreme on the legalistic side and avoiding the extreme on the lawless side. There is no way the Christian can live apart from imposing upon himself a very severe self-discipline and also exercising discernment so that he can see what is worthwhile and what is worthless. He has to sift out the wheat from the chaff. This is what the writer to the Hebrews said. There were people there that he was trying to teach. And he said, I'd like to give you some more teaching, but I'm afraid you haven't developed in your knowledge of the Scriptures. And because you have not developed in your knowledge of the Scriptures, you are not able to discern right from wrong. You are unskilled. You need milk instead of meat. You are immature. The solid food, he says, is for the mature, for those who have their faculties trained by practice to discern between the good and the evil. But he says you can't discern between the good and the evil because you're not mature, and you're not mature because you have not devoted yourself to the Scriptures, and so you don't know God's mind. How can you discern between the good and the bad if you don't know what God is saying about things? You're immature, he says. So what we as Christians have to do is to become mature. And we become mature as we devote ourselves to the Scriptures, we saturate ourselves with what God is saying, and then we apply that knowledge to all the situations we meet in life. To our possessions, to our work, to our families, to our hobbies, our leisure times, whatever it is, we apply those principles of God's Word and we discern. As it says here, we discern, we distinguish between the good and the evil. our minds are transformed, as Paul says. You know that very well-known verse in Romans chapter 12, verse 2. He says, don't be conformed to the world. And that really can summarize all that I've said. Don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed. Well, how are you transformed? You're transformed by the renewal of your mind. That's what the man in Hebrews has just said. You can distinguish. Because you have grown in grace, you've grown in the knowledge of God and His Word, your mind is transformed, and when your mind is transformed, you are able to distinguish between one and the other. Be not conformed, but be transformed by the renewal of your minds. One could go on speaking of this subject and elaborating upon all the texts where Paul talks about this sort of thing. I'll just conclude with this one reference where he wrote to the Philippians. And he said to them, this is my prayer for you, that your love may abound more and more with knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve what is excellent. Now that's what we're talking about, isn't it? We're trying to work out what is worldly and what is not worldly, what is spiritual and what is of the flesh. So we have to discern our course of action. Now he says, I'm praying for you that you might grow and that you might be filled with knowledge and discernment, then you will approve what is excellent and you will be pure and blameless for the day of Christ. You'll be filled with the fruits of righteousness which come through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. In other words, he says, you'll find out that all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, you'll recognize it when you see it. And you'll be able to say, that is not of the Father. That is a wrong attitude. The Christian would not have that approach to things. And he says, you'll be able to handle the situation as it rises. And then you'll please God. You'll be pure and blameless for the day of Christ. You'll be filled with the fruits of righteousness which come through Jesus Christ to the praise and the glory of God. You'll realize that all these other things pass away, the world and everything within it. But because you're doing the will of God, you will stand firm, you will abide forever.